This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Berkeley Life Nitric Oxide Support Supplements. Nitric oxide is a vital signaling molecule in cardiovascular health. We all make nitric oxide in our bodies, but as we age, it starts to diminish naturally. Being proactive in maintaining nitric oxide levels is vital for healthful aging because an underperforming cardiovascular system will limit the effectiveness of any other supplementation in your regimen. Just two capsules of Berkeley Life daily provides the dietary nitrate equivalent of 7 ounces of beets and can support energy levels, maintain healthy blood pressure levels, and improve general circulation. It's the professional-grade nitric oxide supplement that I recommend and prescribe for my patients. This is only available from healthcare providers. To get your Berkeley Life professional supplements, just go to drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life. That's drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life. You can also get Berkeley Life's patented nitric oxide test strips to conveniently test your own nitric oxide levels safely and easily at home. That's drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life for Berkeley Life nitric oxide supplements. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today, we've invited a guest who's going to provide us with a unique perspective on the coronavirus pandemic. She's Dr. Ailey Cohen. And Dr. Cohen is author of a book that's soon to be released from Oxford Press, The Non-Toxic Guide to Living Healthy in a Chemical World. She is a board-certified rheumatologist, but she practices using a functional medicine model, which makes her kind of unique because, probably there's a mere handful of integrative rheumatologists in the country. She's founder and medical director at Integrative Rheumatology Associates, which is in New Jersey, and she's founder and medical director at thesmarthuman.com. Lots of resources there because Smart Human is on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And welcome, Ailey. It's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine. You visited us a few months ago to talk about chemical exposure. And that's the unique angle that you bring to the fore in an article which you just wrote along with Fred Von Saal, who's your collaborator. How toxic chemicals contribute to COVID-19 deaths. You say there, chronic diseases, many linked to chemical exposures, are worsening the pandemic sweeping the U.S. So that is a very interesting perspective because we know that, comorbidities, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, those are part and parcel of the risk profile for people who are coming down with coronavirus. Toxic chemicals, how do they enter into the equation?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. First of all, it's a pleasure to be back. I always enjoy this show. I want to share with your audience, similar to what you were describing in the op-ed, kind of the starting mantra of how environmental chemicals may actually play a pretty strong role in severity of COVID, perhaps even, susceptibility to COVID-19 and other infections. What's been discovered for a long period of time is that, metabolic disease, which many Americans have, in fact, 6 in 10 Americans in this country have at least one comorbid condition, which many have heard about is one of the issues when it comes to COVID and severity, is many of these really sickest of the sick patients really have one at least comorbidity, whether it's high blood pressure or heart disease, diabetes, obesity, asthma, emphysema, chronic obstructive lung disease, also autoimmune disease, chronic kidney disease. Anyone who's had a transplant, that type of thing. We now know that so many Americans walk around on a daily basis with these comorbid conditions, which often come from diet, nutrition issues, and chemicals that we are surrounded by every day actually cause a great deal of inflammation in the human body. And a lot of attention, particularly in the inflammasome system of the immune system, creating all sorts of haywire, including IL-6, which is a cytokine. And what's interesting is the treatments that they're looking at, one of them includes a drug that lowers IL-6. So really trying to connect the dots is that we have this upstream regulatory issue on chemicals that we've had since the 1950s. And it's kind of making Americans sick, actually globally, human beings, where we walk around with a baseline level of inflammation that sort of primes us for these insults, and in this case, COVID-19, so that the inflammation is actually fueled by this infection that we've never seen before.
Well, one of the chief comorbidities for a bad outcome with COVID-19 is obesity. And I think you could make a strong case that environmental chemicals can contribute to this. I mean, yes, Americans eat too much, too many calories, and they don't exercise enough, sedentary lifestyles. Okay, fine, we get that. But there's something else happening here that may impair our body's metabolism so that many of us are accumulating lots and lots of toxic fat.
Yeah, and what you're alluding to is the group of chemicals that's really been discovered in the last 20 or so years called endocrine disrupting chemicals, which are the chemicals that are pesticides and many of the chemicals in processed foods and many of the chemicals that are in makeup and personal care products and cleaning products. You know, endocrine disrupting chemicals are basically chemicals that have the ability to disrupt the normal workings of the hormones in our body, the endocrine system, which is so unbelievably delicate. That many of these chemicals act as low-level estrogens, testosterone, thyroid inhibitors. They affect fertility in terms of the hormones that are related to that, as well as growth and development in utero for infants. So we now know that these chemicals that are sort of everywhere and in everything we do, even food packaging, for instance, water contamination, what they're doing is basically getting into our body and slowly manipulating it. And one of the, hormone-related activities of the body is actually the usage of glucose and insulin release, so that we can release insulin from the pancreas and kind of gobble up glucose and kind of create a normal, stable sugar level in our body. But what we're seeing now is these endocrine-disrupting chemicals have the ability to disrupt that process and create fat cells, make them larger, essentially create an inflammatory situation where you have obesity, and that's predisposing us to a higher issue with a harder, you know, a more difficult issue when it comes to infection. And we see this because the numbers show that a very large proportion of patients that actually end up hospitalized, not the patients that actually recover, which is about 80% of those infected, but those who end up going into the hospitalized environment have typically one of these comorbid conditions, and often it's obesity and hypertension and diabetes are the top three.
And another way that some of these environmental chemicals present in our food and water may impact metabolism is by damaging our microbiome. That's thought to be another pathway, right?
Yeah. I mean, our gut microbiome is we have lots of biomes in our body in terms of where we have these microbes, whether they're bacteria, yeast, viruses, they all technically live on us and in us. But the gut, which is essentially 24 or more or less feet of bowel, is a very sensitive environment for these bacteria that have been living with us for millions of years. And they're rather easily disrupted through medications, which can knock them off in our gut, but also contaminated drinking water, chlorinated drinking water with detergents that are allowable, food chemicals, including pesticides, which, you know, kill off bacteria in the fields. But of course, they do that to our gut, which has bacteria. Stress certainly can change the pH of the gut environment and affect the balance of microbes in the gut. And all of this essentially can affect our immune system, because our immune system is essentially impacted greatly by the strength of our gut microbiome. And so it's just one route. There's several routes into the body, certainly through skin with, you know, bisphenol A and some of these chemicals that we touch on receipts. Components of canned and packaged foods like bisphenol A in cans, phthalates. We have feminine care products, which, believe it or not, actually is a very important route into the body in terms of chemicals and absorption.
Phthalates, for example. You know?
What do you say?
Phthalates, for example.
Yeah, phthalates. I guess I'm probably saying it wrong. But,
no.
I say it in 10 different ways. But, you know, the other thing is
air tomato, pollution. I say tomato.
Yeah, exactly. Air pollution, a very important study just came out of Harvard, Chan School of Public Health, regarding air pollution. And what they found was really that just a very small increase in air pollutants actually increases risk for morbidity and mortality from COVID by about 20-fold.
Wow.
So we know that even air pollution and really can have a really big effect. And that's probably through the process of inflammation again. So, you know, what we should be thinking about is how do we reduce inflammation in our lives, and how will we set ourselves up for issues down the line should there be another pandemic, or even while we're trying to stay healthy or recover from this infection? What can we do to do that?
Maybe this explains a paradox that I've been thinking about, which is, you know, when this coronavirus pandemic began and then it swept through Europe and then the United States and, you know, certainly affected Asia, I thought, boy, you know, we're going to be in for a huge problem worldwide, and we are. But I thought that it was going to hit especially hard in sub-Saharan Africa and in India, the so-called underdeveloped countries. But paradoxically, it doesn't seem, I mean, unless they're just not communicating the dimensions of the tragedy, you know, we're not seeing, like, the bodies pile up in places where perhaps there's less pollution, perhaps the food is less adulterated. I'm just thinking out loud here. Is that a plausible scenario for...
I think that's a really important question, and I think no one really has the answer for it yet, other than, you know, people are thinking in terms of temperature and humidity and whether or not that's going to play a role in the United States come fall when our weather changes. You know, whether people, because it's warm, just happen to behaviorally be outdoors more or be separated more. And that, too, would change if the weather changed. So I don't know if we know the answers to this entirely. There are certainly cases in the Philippines where it's warm. Australia?
It has been bad there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think all bets are off right now in terms of making that kind of real. I mean, almost everything. All bets are off right now. I mean, it's just one of those times where I think we're just trying to see trends, and we're starting to see a few trends here and there that I think are really clinically valuable to practitioners and their patients. But I think the most clear one that I'm seeing, and I think most people would agree, is that the numbers point to, you know, kind of if you're sick or you have an underlying illness, or if your lifestyle may be leading to some type of metabolic issue, that it's a good time to really work on that, because those are really, that's in general, not the outliers, but in general, that tends to be the trend. More people that are obese, like I said, are affected in a more negative way. It turns out more men than women are hospitalized, and certainly more minorities. And so we really need to think about this in terms of moving forward and how we're going to handle that, even through, health equity and, how we're going to handle the disparity in who gets the information they need for improved lifestyle.
Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share this vital message with you. This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman with one of my personal solutions to better cardiovascular health, Berkeley Life Nitric Oxide Support Supplements. Just 2 capsules of Berkeley Life daily provide the dietary nitrate equivalent of 7 ounces of beets and can support cardiovascular health, maintain healthy blood pressure levels, and improve overall circulation. For more information and to purchase, just go to drhoffman.com/berkeleylife. drhoffman.com/berkeleylife. Berkeley Life Nitric Oxide Support Supplements. This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Healthy Aging, providing you with the unique energy support of Pure NT Factor. D-Factor is the only nutritional formula clinically proven to reduce fatigue, whatever the cause, whether it be age, illness, or just being run down. And T-Factor from Nutritional Therapeutics repairs damaged cells and restores healthy bacteria in your digestive tract. Clinical trials have shown N-T-Factor reduces fatigue by almost half, and it even reverses some symptoms of aging. I've been taking N-T-Factor for years with a 45-day money-back guarantee of nothing to lose. To order, call 800-982-9158. That's 800-982-9158. Or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine the continuing free resource to you. And now back to our guest, Dr. Ailey Cohen. When you work with patients, and obviously a theme in your practice is avoiding chemical exposures and avoiding or minimizing environmental exposures to optimize health, we can test for blood pressure, we can test for blood sugar, we can test for cholesterol. You know, those are sort of clear markers. We can do a body composition, or we can simply get a tape measure out and measures people's waist-to-hip ratio. We can determine if they're metabolically fit from that standpoint. But is there a way you can do an assessment on what their toxic burden is? You know, the levels of heavy metals, the levels of environmental chemicals that people have been imbibing, or is that too challenging a task?
Well, I think, first of all, working with people individually and just getting a really excellent environmental health history. I'm a physician almost 20 years now, and now I'm an autoimmune disease specialist or rheumatologist. And so my journey has taken me, a long way, and I still feel like I'm on this journey. But what I have kind of felt is that looking back at my training, which is very similar to where it was, is now as it was 20 years ago or 40 years ago, or I should say 30 years ago, we don't learn nutrition. We don't learn environmental health testing. We don't learn how to ask the questions of exposure because it's not built into the cake of understanding how our environment affects human health. I think that has to change. And when it comes to getting, testing, which is what you're asking, what we know about many of these chemicals, of course, not all, there's 90,000 chemicals that actually are available in all of our products, from cleaning products to, food chemicals, over 3,000 are used in our food, processed foods. We have so many industrial chemicals, they all are able to get into our body, whether it's through drinking water that's contaminated, whether it's, like I said, through diet or putting on lotions. It varies day to day with some of these chemicals. Mm-hmm. For instance, BPA has a half-life, which means about 50% of it will reduce, every day, more or less, 50% of its previous amount. So it's not just overnight. It takes several days, but it has a 6-hour half-life. So essentially, if you gave up foods, or I should say packaging that has BPA, for instance, like canned foods, drinks, and foods all have BPA on the inside lining of the cans, the plastic coating. And studies have shown this, that you can actually lower your BPA levels in your urine, which is how it's tested. So we know that behaviors can change those levels. And how that plays into disease obviously takes into account the person's genetics and other parts of their lifestyle. But testing is so variable because we are always inundated with different amounts of chemicals on a daily basis. So if you test one day, you might likely have a very different level of the same chemical the next day or even a week later. And that, I think, opens up more questions than answers. I think the way to understand how to do the testing properly, so that you get more information out of it than more questions, is really to get a great environmental history, understand what the components are of their symptoms, mm-hmm. How it may relate to their occupational exposures, how it may relate to their diet or their drinking water and where they live and what those levels might be. Get an idea of personal care products and their home products, home furnishings, couches, that kind of thing, and then make a safe and efficient set of lab tests that are appropriate, because many of them are out of pocket. They're not covered right. by.
So in other words, you might selectively test. You might say, somebody perhaps who is, a furniture finisher, you might say, oh my goodness, you have occupational exposure to, let's say, toluene or volatile organic hydrocarbons. Yeah. there you might do, but for the ordinary person, you know, who's maybe driving in their car, you're going to assume that they're getting some background exposure to all of these things through household products and furnishings and so on, but not at the level where you have to pinpoint it. So I think what you're saying is, you know, rather than test the patient, you need to take a very good environmental history, which is something that most of the time doctors don't do. You know, they'll just say, okay, are you working in a battery factory? Okay, fine, you're fine.
They don't ask. I mean, you know, most doctors, I mean, they're my colleagues and the system is set up this way, but you really only have about 15 minutes with your doctor. Mm-hmm. And so when you're, you know, or half an hour if you're lucky, but you're really only going to cover pretty much your medications and anything new that happened. But chances are there's not going to be a question about what your day-to-day exposures are, be it at home or it's at work. Certainly not a dietary history. And most doctors are not equipped to answer the questions surrounding those lifestyle behaviors. So, you know, I think that that's why it has to go upstream to medical schools and try to get this information where it's the beginning of our training. I personally am trying to teach high school students nationally on the topics of health prevention through, you know, diet and nutrition and sleep and stress. Because I think if you get to the consumer, you actually might be much more effective than waiting for med schools to change their policies and their curriculum.
I haven't seen your book yet because it's actually not out yet, but Non-Toxic, The Guide to Living Living Health in a Chemical World. Is that the correct title?
Yeah, it's Guide to Living Healthy in a Chemical World. And it's actually available for pre-order because it's coming out pretty soon.
Good. And I presume in there are, you know, detailed questionnaires that help people identify sources of exposure that might clue them into the potential for environmental toxicity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, this is my my baby of 7 or 8 years, partnered with Fred Vomsahl, who is just world-renowned researcher on bisphenol A. So between his research background, which is unbelievable, and my clinical work, you know, we really tried to make this cover quite a few issues that people would have, from history and regulation all the way to what to do. So it's a guidebook, and there's no guidebook that I've seen that's out there that really tries to lay out what to do in a very cost-effective, practical, common sense kind of way. From food to drinking water and filtration, you know, what to bring in your house for cleaning. You know, we have refrigerator tear-off sheets. We have information for new parents or people who are trying to become pregnant and what to think about with their bodies and what they should think about with their children. So it's kind of the book that I wish I had when I was pregnant. It's kind of, you know, it's soup to nuts, and I think it's very simplistic, but it's really hopefully easy to understand and certainly helping people to be proactive. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is a good point at which to pause because, as our listeners know, we divided our podcast into two parts. And in part two, I have some additional questions for you. I want to, you know, I want to tap your expertise as a rheumatologist about hydroxychloroquine, which is Plaquenil, popular rheumatological medication, and your impressions about the role that it might play in dealing with the coronavirus. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest is Dr. Ailey Cohen. Dr. Cohen is a board-certified rheumatologist, which means she deals with autoimmune conditions like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis and other related conditions in her daily practice. But she is an integrative rheumatologist, which means she also looks at a wide variety of factors for their patients, not just the opportunity to apply medication to their predicaments. And when we return, we've got more to discuss. So we'll be right back. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.